Hello, everybody. This is Evan Brand, your host of Not Just Paleo. Welcome to the show. If you're a first-time listener, you have a lot of backtracking to do, so I'm really happy that you found me now, and that way you have less work than you will a month from now. So there's a bunch of topics that I cover on this show, whether it's brain health and how a paleo diet can help brain health as far as getting the proper fats in your diet so that your brain doesn't have to compete for the omega-6 fats and things like that. And then I'll cover topics like feet and footwear, like I'm covering today with Dr. Ray from Portland, who is a foot doctor who's been specializing in helping people stay on their feet for the past 20 years. So it's a really good episode, and I'm excited to bring this into your consciousness. You know, footwear's always been one of those weird things for me in the whole paleo world. We see the barefoot shoes that have popped up, and we get into those today and all of the other ins and outs of modern footwear and how that helps or prevents us from achieving a natural and healthy foot. So before we get into that, I just want to tell you thanks so much for coming out to the webinar that Kevin and I did for the launch of my sleep book and audio book, Rim Rehab. It was super successful, and I can't thank you all enough. I mean, it was just really great to be able to have that many people in the room listening and picking up copies of the book. So if you haven't yet, you can go to my website, notjustpaleo.com, and then if you look in the menu bar, you'll see books, and then just click books, and then you'll see Rim Rehab, the cover art for it, and then you'll see the two packages. So you can get the ebook and the support group to where Kevin and I will be in there kind of tweaking your bedroom and lifestyle habits, and it's basically like a free personal coaching session. So you can get that, or you can get the ebook, the audio book, and the private support group. So either package you choose, they're both really awesome. I mean, you know how I am about putting passion into things, and this is definitely my best work yet. And I have many more things in the works as far as tackling other health issues. But sleep was my biggest problem, you know, back when I worked at UPS third shift, and it made me super depressed, you know, on a physical level and a mental level. I couldn't burn fat, even though I wasn't fat, but I couldn't build muscle either. So I hope you go check that out and enjoy this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and let's do it. We'll go ahead and get started if you're ready.
Oh, that sounds great.
All right. Well, I'm back here with Dr. Ray. Is that McClanahan?
You got it, yeah.
All right. From Portland, Oregon, who is a podiatrist and has worked for many years educating people on foot conditions, and is an active runner and athlete who finished 14th in the U.S. National Men's Cross Country Championships and had a near Olympic trial qualifying 5,000 meter mark of 13 minutes and 56 seconds in 2000. He then qualified for the world, what is that, duathlon championships in 2001. Awesome. All right. Well, hey, well, thanks for coming on to my show.
Yeah, my pleasure, Evan.
So 13:56, is that really fast for a 5,000 meter?
Well, it was for me at the time, but if you look at the whole spectrum of, you know, how many guys out there are running a lot faster than that, it's really not that fast. I'd say this state of running right now, that'd be a good college time, but that certainly wouldn't be considered an elite time.
Yeah, well, that's still way faster than I would do it, I'll tell you that. I think I ran maybe a 6 minute and 15 second mile at my best in like eighth grade or something, you know, and then that was
pretty
much
good. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then, I ran the 200 meter also, and I was pretty quick. I don't remember my time or anything. I remember being pretty fast. I never got first, but I remember getting at least second or third. And my last race, I was on the red clay, that, you know, the red sandy clay, and took the last turn right there, or that turn on the 200 meter. And I don't know if I slipped or tripped or what, but I ended up doing like a 10-foot long slide on my knees.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. But I ended up getting up and at least finishing the race. But I think that was like my way out of my running career.
I see.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, tell people a little bit about your practice and what you've been up to for the past pretty much two decades.
Yeah, my practice primarily tries to help out people who like to walk and hike and run. And we, back in 1999, decided to test an idea that really is not our idea at all. It's been an idea that has been written about in the medical literature for at least 100 years that I'm aware of. And that idea is that maybe the human foot is designed to do everything we'll ask it to do just the way it is. And so I actually was very fortunate to read the writings of Dr. William Rossi, and I would encourage our audience to take the opportunity to read some of his work. Unfortunately, he passed on about probably 10 years ago, but he left a wealth of articles on particularly footwear. He was a very interesting guy in that he started out in the foot care world fitting shoes for his parents' shoe store. And he then went on to become a podiatrist, and then he went on to consult for many shoe companies. And over the course of his involvement with the shoe companies and studying the foot and how footwear was built, he basically came to the realization that much of what we market to people is not really what people need, and quite frankly, can many times be harmful. And I'll never forget the evening in 1999 when I read his work for the first time. It was published in Podiatry Management magazine at that time, a leading trade magazine in podiatry, and it was called Why Shoes Make Normal Gait Impossible. And at that time, I thought I knew a lot about shoes, and I thought shoes were good, and I thought that they helped our gait, and they helped control pronation and cured injuries and so forth. But the writings of Dr. Rossi, based on real-world experience, traveling around the world, looking at feet from other cultures, as well as his awareness of how shoes are built, basically I came away from reading that article with the thought that I'd like to try this in my own practice. I'd like to start encouraging my patient population to rely less on footwear, rely less on rigid orthotics and arch supports and so forth. I should also be honest and tell you that at that time I was also struggling with a lot of my own injuries. That was during the time that I was competing at my highest level. And I was taking way too much Advil, way too many painkillers, too many cortisone shots. And essentially that was just so I could continue training at a high intensity. And what I realize now is that much of the mistakes that I made were never allowing my foot to really do what a foot is designed to do in the act of running. And so essentially overnight I started employing the principles that Dr. Rossi talked about, which are there's no good reason to have an elevated heel on your footwear ever for any person for any reason. There's no good reason why the natural human shape of the foot should be changed by our footwear. But that's exactly what happens. And essentially, Dr. Rossi portrayed a very compelling chronology of what happens to most American people over the course of our lifetime. We start very early in our life changing the shape of our foot from a foot that's naturally supposed to be widest at the ends of the toes to the typical adult foot that I see in my clinic, which is now widest at the ball of the foot. And so I began telling the patients about these principles, and I also was very keen to see if I could get away from my own miseries of one sort and another. And the good news was our patient population took to it very well, had very good success with it. A lot of my own issues went away. And I was actually dealing with a condition myself at the time of and called overlapping toe. For our audience members, that's when typically your second toe sits up on top of your great toe. It's also called a hammer toe and a bunion. And at that time, I was training to do a lot of those types of surgical corrections, and I really wasn't sure that I wanted to have that done on my own foot. And so I began thinking about what Dr. Rossi wrote about, and I began literally changing my footwear by cutting my footwear, stretching my footwear, relacing it, removing orthotics and liners. And essentially what I saw and what many of our patients have seen is we can literally take the shape of our foot that has been slowly crippled over the course of our lifetime and rehab it back to what nature had in mind for us. And so that's what we've been up to for the last about a decade and a half now. And we're very, very pleased with the results. Our patient population really is happy with, you know, trying to address their movement patterns in a more natural way.
Yeah, you had a lot of golden nuggets in there already, and I want to get into some of those. But I'm curious, how long does it take to fix a person's foot? Is there like a standard minimum time that it takes to fix it?
Not really. I would say it depends largely on how old the individual is. It depends upon the type of footwear they've worn, how many years they've worn that type of footwear. It depends upon their own soft tissue characteristics. Some people are built very stout and very rigid. Other people are built very hyper-flexible, if you will. And so those are some of the other things that will play into it. But I would say our typical patient is probably a fourth or fifth decade female, coming to the clinic, feels the toes are starting to change. Maybe one side has a bunion or both sides. And that particular individual is probably, depending upon the severity of their situation, looking at least a year, if not 2 to 3 years, before they can actually engage their foot the way their foot was meant to function. So that is the downside of the way we practice, as is the case with most things natural. It doesn't happen quickly. And people really have to make a determined effort on their own behalf to take charge of their own foot health and basically not give up all their control and autonomy to the shoe store and the podiatrist.
Wow. So what actually happens when a bunion forms? Is that actually skin? Is there blood being stuck there? Or what actually happens?
What happens is, if you look at the shape of a baby's foot, any of ours, when we're born, you know how they stamp our little footprint into a ink pad and put it on the paper to, you know, and put what time you were born and so forth. If you look at that for any one of us, you're going to notice that the widest part of the natural human foot at birth is at the ends of the toes. And so most people don't really make the distinction, and the fact that their foot changes so slowly over time, they don't realize, you know, that they've been gradually steered away from that natural foot shape. But what, to answer your question, Evan, what a bunion is the big toe is progressively pushed towards the second toe over the course of our lifetime, that in certain individuals around the typical ones I see are third, fourth decade, although you can also see them in younger people. But really what a bunion is, and I'm so glad you're asking this, because there's a load of misinformation out there about what a bunion really is and what needs to be done about it. Truthfully, a bunion is a partially dislocated big toe joint. And the cause of that is from the footwear. If you look at the foot at birth, like we talked about, you look at the baby shoes, everything's okay for a year or two. But I would urge any of our audience members who happen to be going to the beach, a water park, to look at the kids' feet. And what they'll notice is that from about age birth to 2, 3, 4 years old, the feet typically maintain that natural foot shape. They still look pretty good. They're still widest at the ends of the toes. But then if you look really carefully, you start noticing 7, 8, 9, 10, some of the kids' toes are no longer spreading out wider. And then you get into the adolescent age group, and you literally start to see the foot deformities that I'm trained to treat. So most of this occurs very slowly and gradually, which is why not enough attention, I think, gets applied to it early enough. And couple that with the fact that much of what is taught to people to do is not successful, you end up seeing an awful lot of people that get to a spot where they think surgery is their only option.
Wow. Yeah, I've been to a water park, and I'll tell you, there's some nasty feet out there. I mean, it's just crazy how deformed people's feet get. And I've always looked at shoes as this sort of weird thing, especially the ones that just cram all of your toes in. I mean, especially for women with the dress shoes and the typical office wear. I mean, that's got to be horrible. Can you tell us about those shoes and what they do?
Yeah, definitely. They are horrible, Evan. You're absolutely right. In fact, if any of our readers want to get a kind of a glimpse of how horrible they potentially can be, there was a study done, I want to say 3 years ago now. I want to say it was in the Journal of Investigational Biology, and it's on our website, where they looked at women in one group. They had the women that wore the typical 2-inch heel. In another group, they had women go barefoot or in a flat shoe. And at the variable interval, they measured their calf muscles and their Achilles tendons and found that in the group of gals that went in the 2-inch heel, they were 13% shorter. So the biggest detriment of an elevated heel, and by the way, it doesn't have to be stiletto high. A lot of my female patients come in state rather proudly that I've never really worn high-heeled shoes. But my comment to them and my comment to almost anybody would be that the reality in America is you don't have to wear a stiletto heel as a woman to develop foot deformity and foot abnormality. In fact, all you have to do is wear much of what's available to you, and you're going to end up at some point developing many of the things that will ail adult Americans. So the biggest thing with this high heel is the shortening of the calf muscle. And the downside of that is it places undue pressure on the front of a person's foot. Our foot is designed, as Dr. Rossi wrote about, to equally bear weight between the heel and the whole front of the foot, which includes our toes. However, when you start going with a high-heeled shoe, you not only decrease the flexibility of your calf tendons, you end up artificially holding your toe bones in an elevated position, which they also learn. So not only is the high heel shortening the muscles on the back of the leg, it also shortens the muscles on the front of the leg, which are called your extensor muscles. So it's just a recipe for disaster, and unfortunately, most of the gals that wear those are still quite young. Their body is still quite good at compensating, so they don't yet have an awareness of what is waiting for them in another couple of decades.
Wow, so we need to convince all the women that flat shoes are the sexy shoes, then, of the future.
I sure think so. One of our naturopathic associates, Dr. Hughes, has written extensively about that being one of her goals for her professional career, to redefine what sexy and fashionable is for women. And our message would be that we're not trying to tell people never dress up and never wear, you know, something that is more fashionable, but be keenly aware of what the consequences are, and in particular, if you can, limit your amount of time in that kind of footwear.
Yeah, so you know what's really popular, at least here, and I'm sure in Portland where you are too, is the boots. You know, the boots really took off the past few years for women. The, you know, the brown, almost knee highs with,
yep.
I would say maybe a, I don't know, what would you say, maybe a 2-inch heel on those, and then they have kind of like a slight tilt to them also.
So, yep, definitely. Yeah, it's one of the downsides too is it's very, very difficult to find the kind of footwear that we prescribe and have it look anything remotely fashionable to most women.
Yeah. How do you feel about the Vibram shoes?
Well, I really love them. I've had many positive experiences in them myself, but I'd have to say overwhelmingly they frighten me mostly because of what people are doing to themselves through lack of awareness. In other words, a lot of folks are buying them. They feel good. It feels like they're barefoot. But then they overdo it without the awareness that their foot in particular has become so tremendously weak with most of the westernized footwear that to adopt that kind of a footwear immediately, it ends up creating a lot of injuries that unfortunately send the wrong message. They send the message that having a footwear selection that's flat and lets your foot work is wrong. The real message that I think should be sent is that kind of footwear is absolutely wonderful and appropriate, but we need to take our time getting used to it.
Yeah, definitely. I've heard of people, you know, finding out about barefoot shoes kind of like I did, and some people will go and run a 5K or something as soon as they switch over, but there's definitely a work-in period to these things because, I mean, even me, I would just wear them for an hour or two a day before switching fully over, and my calves, I mean, whoa, you wouldn't believe the workout they get. So basically, I mean, are we getting muscle atrophy too throughout our whole legs and our whole lower body just from having the wrong type of shoe?
We sure are, and one of the groups of muscle that we're getting the greatest atrophy in, and I think is getting some of the attention right now, is what we call the plantar intrinsics. Those are the little arch muscles. Mm-hmm. And when you look at what footwear does to our feet and the fact that we've kind of believed in this philosophy of arch support and orthotics, we've largely put those little muscles to sleep. And some of the studies that are going on right now show how truly important they are as foundational supporters, you know, to make sure that we can meaningfully move our body the way we're intended. So, yeah, we definitely create dysfunction in the anterior group and in the posterior group, but we also, unfortunately, overstretch the little arch muscles. We stretch them longer than they're intended to be stretched, and then they don't function. And then you start to get deformities that basically overpower the foot, and then you've got a recipe for ongoing foot problems.
Wow, makes sense. I mean, I've had high arches my whole life. I've always been curious about the whole arch support thing, because sometimes you see people, their foot is as flat as a piece of paper, but mine is like a, I don't know, it's huge. It's a huge arch, and So
I always believe that the higher arch is probably the better arch to have for most folks. Although I would also share with you, Evan, a lot of the science that we're looking at right now suggests that maybe your arch height and maybe your arch flexibility perhaps isn't the most important variable to be looking at. A lot of the shoe fitting processes in years past has tried to help people figure out, you know, if you have a high arch or a low arch or a medium arch and choose your shoes accordingly. But quite frankly, no matter what kind of arch you have, there's the potential to have a very healthy foot if you understand, you know, what a healthy foot is capable of and make sure that footwear doesn't impede that.
Yeah. See, the hard part is people like me, you know, I'm around fitness equipment, anything from, you know, a 10-pound kettlebell to a 90-pound kettlebell, which would hurt pretty bad to drop on your toe. And so, you know, I don't wear my barefoot shoes, but I try to wear just, you know, a little bit thicker of a flat shoe at work. But I mean, what would the recommendation be for that? You know, somebody that has to work in, say, construction or police or fire. I mean, all these guys that are on their feet all day, there's got to be some type of solution, right?
I sure think there is, Evan. We've been suggesting it for years. We just haven't yet gotten a partner to go there with us. Our suggestion is to make safety footwear for all of those types of activities that you described that allows whatever safety feature they need to be in that shoe, but also have the shoe be shaped like a natural human foot. For instance, most steel-toed boots that a lot of our clients end up needing to wear create deformity and, you know, create foot disability. But you're awfully hard-pressed to find a steel-toed safety boot that isn't built like they've classically been built. So we keep humbly telling our message, and we've made some successes, just not in that category of footwear. You know, we've got some partners in the walking, running footwear industry. But, yeah, that's still one of the many categories of footwear that we have yet to establish a partner who believes in building footwear that we believe it needs to be built.
Yeah, so I mean, if you say you could find a boot, I mean, what would you want to look for? Would you want to, I mean, say you had to get steel toe, could you look for something that just didn't have that massive, for some reason, I think they, guys, I don't know, they think guys want to be taller or something, and they add those huge heels to boots, work boots and stuff like that. But I mean, do you think the best thing we could do is to look for a more flat boot?
I sure do, Evan. In fact, we had this conversation last week. I happen to live in a community where they have a custom bootmaker who's very well known here in Oregon, and the gentleman that came in to describe his foot concern brought in his footwear, as they typically do. And you're absolutely right. His boot had a rigid 2-inch heel. And so you can extrapolate the same study results we talked about with the gals a moment ago, getting a 13% shortening of their calf muscles. It's certainly happening to the guys as well. And the gals are always telling me they want to be taller, and that's one of the reasons why they wear heels, but I can't say that I've ever heard that yet from a male.
Oh, I bet you there's a lot of guys out there with short man syndrome, though. I've seen some that are 5'4", and they have 5-inch boots on. You know, it's it's pretty funny. But so the arch support thing is a myth, really.
I sure think it is, but for anybody that wants to dig a little deeper into that question, I wrote an article specifically called Arch Support. And in that article, I basically asked, what is it, and how do you apply it, and when do you need it? And quite frankly, I again want to be very straightforward with the audience and let them know that Dr. Rossi was the person who really got me thinking about these ideas. So reading his articles, as well as reading the Arch Support article, are probably going to give our audience members enough information to make their own informed decision. But in a nutshell, an arch, as you're familiar, Evan, is a structure that basically supports itself over an open space. And so the common example out in nature would be the bridge. And if you study that construct, it's architecturally stable in and of itself because both ends are flat and level. However, even though the foot is built that way, when you talk to people about supporting the arch of the foot, they literally flip that definition upside down. And they essentially change the definition. Their definition is to put something up under the open space, where the true definition of arch support is have both support ends on a level platform. So if there were one very solid reason for the zero drop mentality that's coming about in footwear right now, it's that you really actually want your heel level with your forefoot while you're out there active and doing the things that you like to do.
Wow. You know something that's crazy, Dr. Ray? Every episode that I do, I find out everything is the complete opposite of the way it's supposed to be, whether it's footwear or diet recommendations or, you know, sleep or anything. I mean, it's just crazy how backwards everything got. And I guess it all had to go back to money eventually because these companies were wanting to market shoes to people. I mean, we've always had some type of shoe, I guess, the modern human with moccasins and, you know, skin hides and stuff like that. But do you know much about the history of shoes? Like, when did we start really screwing ourselves up?
Well, there's one study also on the website that you might want to look at, or the audience might want to look at, that does attempt to answer some of that question. It was a 2005 article, and the lead author's last name is Mays, M-A-Y-S. And what he and his researchers did is they literally excavated, I think, 1,200 years of human skeletal remains, might have been 1,500. But the whole goal for their project was, when did we get osteoarthritis, and in what joints did it first become apparent, and at what time in history, and what time in the past recorded history. And what's quite compelling from the conclusion is roughly around the same time as modern footwear became available, and I don't remember the exact dates, I want to say 300-400 years ago perhaps, and bear in mind that modern footwear had the elevated heel, had the pointed toe box, etc., we saw within that generation, and it has stayed consistent since, osteoarthritis of the big toe, the midfoot, and the medial compartment of the knee. So I think we really started messing ourselves up on a subtle level probably 200-300 years ago, and I think we really started messing ourselves up on a significant level in the last 25-30 years, particularly in our active footwear. Here's where I, like I said a moment ago, I don't mind if a person wants to go out at night and go to the ballet or go to the theater and wear something nice that we know isn't good for their foot, matches their style and their outfit, and they're in it for a couple of hours, and that's no big deal. I treat and care for a group of people who come in and they say things like, I want to approach Everest Base Camp. I want to do this 50-kilometer. You know, I want to go climb this mountain. So to those people especially, I say, you don't want any fashion component in your footwear at all. And that's when they start to realize that they do have fashion components in their hiking, running, walking shoes. And, you know, so as soon as we can try to get them out of those fashion features, their body starts turning around, and it's so gratifying to see.
Yeah. How do you feel about ankle support on boots?
I think it's the wrong idea. I think, again, if your foot is level, like it should be, there's a natural locking mechanism of the talus bone. If you look at the talus bone, it's the part of the talus that your lower leg bone sit on. It's wider in the front and narrower in the back. And what that means is that any amount of heel elevation causes your lower leg bones to, I'm going to use the word articulate, which means that's the part of the bone they come into contact with. If your foot is level, you come into contact with the wide part of the talus, and it holds your ankle joint stable and secure. And that can only occur if your heel can achieve a level position with your forefoot. And when you look at how many hiking boots out there and how many active footwear selections are out there that have the heel twice as high as the front of the foot, it's no wonder they want to put ankle support design features in there, because they've taken away the integrity of it.
Wow. That's mind blowing right there. I see. I've had both. I've had the kind of the active hiking shoe, and then I've also had the, I guess you would call them the mid tops, where they're not complete combat boots, but you know, when I was working out at the park, I had, I think I had Merrells or Morels, however you say it. I had those, and I don't know. I wish I would have been able to be barefoot, or at least closer to barefoot or flat foot. But I mean, it was so dangerous out there with equipment and, you know, backhoes and shovels and all type of things like that. So I guess it's really hard to get back to our natural state, I guess. You know, the modern life, too, I'd like to be out in the city doing this stuff, too, but the streets are just not too clean. But I guess you're saying there are solutions. Are there any brands out there that you do recommend, or do they exist yet, is the question, I guess.
Yeah, they sure do. Some of our favorite brands for walking, running, and hiking would be, I'd say my favorite brand probably is LEMS, L-E-M-S.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a wonderful hiking boot, which does not have ankle support. I took a sabbatical not long ago, and I took my sabbatical in the Rocky Mountains, and one of my goals was to test various different footwear, specifically under load. And so I had a very, very good experience with the LEMS. I also am absolutely in love with Altra, A-L-T-R-A. They make a zero-drop shoe, and what I really love about their shoe is they take it to the next level. They make a shoe that is a foot-shaped shoe. And if there were one important feature that I try to get people to pay attention to when purchasing their shoes, is it really should be shaped like a natural foot. And that's when you're going to have the time to educate people about what a natural foot really is. because if we look at each other's feet, our toes are probably narrower than the ball, and that looks normal because that's how we all eventually arrive as Americans in American footwear.
You just got me in trouble. I'll tell you, I love shoes, and I'm looking right here at these Lim shoes. These things are really badass for boots. I mean, these, they look like a boot should look. I mean, when you actually see one that makes sense, it, you know, it all, it kind of clicks with you.
Yeah.
So you're saying that cushion is not necessarily a bad thing?
I don't think so. In fact, any one of us that are involved in this more natural foot movement would tell you that if we're going to go out and we're going to run fast, or if we're going to go out on a mountain pass where there's really jagged rocks, we want a little bit of cushioning. We would also tell you, though, that we believe that the cushioning that's added in the most footwear grossly supersedes what the needs of the human foot are. In fact, that's one of the troubling tendencies I see going on in the industry right now. The running footwear industry is they're making a shift towards extra cushioning. And unfortunately, you know, it might feel good, but it promotes a lazy way of running, and I think it will also ultimately end up creating injury. So a little bit of cushioning is good, and what I mean by that is a little bit so you're just protected from hard objects, but you can still feel the ground. Mm-hmm. Most footwear doesn't allow for that. Most footwear is so overly cushioned, you're feeling the inside of the shoe instead of the ground. And when we talk about proprioception and meaningful movement of the body forward, you do that so much better when you can actually sense with your sensory organs in your feet. And our feet and our hands have some of the most sensory organs. And one of the analogies I always hear that I really enjoy is you wouldn't want to put gloves on a child that you're trying to teach them to be perceptive of their environment.
Yep.
And the same thing, I think, goes with footwear.
Yeah, definitely. See, there's been a big push, too, with the barefoot shoes, though, which is exactly the opposite to where people are buying literally skin thick soles to where you feel everything. And I've had a pair, and it's actually pretty miserable to walk on dirt paths, because even a pebble, even like Muhammad Ali said, I think something along the lines of it's not the climb that gets you on the mountain, but it's the pebble in your shoe. And it's so true, because with these super super barefoot feel, I mean, any little, like you mentioned, any little jagged edge or pebble just kind of pokes you, and eventually you get fatigued and you don't want to stay on the trail, you know? So I just try to end up going off. So,
yeah. One cool thing does happen, though, if you can ease into that kind of a thing very slowly over the course of many years. One of the nice things about the foot, that I can only say there's one other part of the body that this is accomplishable, and that's the hand, is that we can actually develop not only strengthen the muscles, which is critical, we can develop a thicker, tougher skin layer by progressively and simultaneously subjecting it to non-painful, you know, stimulation, which is something I don't think most adult Americans ever get to experience. But as a person who has been working towards this over the last many years, I definitely think it's something that everybody should slowly work towards, because you can actually develop thicker skin.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sure the Native Americans, they probably had really thick feet. I don't know what record their shoe wearing is, but I'm sure that they have tough feet. And anytime I watch any documentary or Planet Earth, you know, some of my favorite nature movies, you always see the Native people and their feet. I mean, it looks like a whole nother, it looks like a shoe. It looks like a sole on the bottom of their feet.
Yeah. It's true. A group of Indians that's been studied really extensively recently is the Tarahumara from the Copper Canyons in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And they, even though they go barefoot quite a bit and have very strong feet, when they race, they put a little tire rubber on the bottom of their foot.
Wow. That's funny. How do they attach it?
They have a little thong leather strap type mechanism that goes between their big toe and their second toe, and then it goes up around their ankle.
Oh, that's funny. I don't know if I could run with that. That gets pretty... I've always avoided the thong sandals for some reason. I've always had like a sensitive section, I guess, in between those, the big and the second toe. Does that change also, I guess? Can that grow and get stronger?
You know, it perhaps could, but I'm exactly like you, Evan. I don't like that at all, so I basically try to avoid that. I suppose I could, you know, try to work up to that, but I think that's a common thing for people not to really want something in between their great toe and second toe. But I suppose these guys have been at it since birth, and maybe that's why it doesn't bother them.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's your shoe regimen like for you? I mean, as far as working in the office and your free time and stuff like that.
Yeah, I am very blessed to get to experiment with a lot of different shoes. I would say my most comfortable office shoe right now is either a pair of Lems. They've got leather and they've also got canvas. I also have a pair of what are called Tune, T-U-N-E, which are a leather loafer, zero-drop foot-shaped shoe that I enjoy quite a bit. If I can get away with it in my office, I'll run around in just in gingy toe socks from time to time or even completely barefoot. I do enjoy some of the Vivo Barefoot line. There's so many good ones out there. I'm sure I'm going to miss mentioning some of them. But essentially anything that's flat, wide at the ends of the toes, and flexible, I have a very good experience with.
Okay. Yeah, see, I see on the pictures here on the Lems website, when they're showing the boot, they show that basically this boot, you can kind of roll it up into a ball almost. Is that a good indicator of the type of shoe that you want to go for?
I sure think it is, Evan, but you got to take your time with it. It's kind of like what we talked about a moment ago. Although it's natural and healthful, and that kind of shoe will definitely build your arches and build your awareness, again, it's something that needs to be approached very slowly and progressively if you haven't been doing that your whole life.
Right. Yeah, see, we've had a guy from this book called Earthing. Are you familiar with that book?
Super familiar.
Awesome.
You had Martin Zucker on there?
Yeah, Martin Zucker. Yeah, he came on the podcast, yeah. I think, maybe two or three episodes back.
And fantastic.
Yeah, he was a cool dude. And we were talking about grounding and, you know, trying to, of course, get your bare feet in the dirt as much as possible. So do any – you mentioned you had a leather loafer. I mean, are the Lems or any other of those shoe brands that you know of, are they also – you know, having an animal hide or something to where we can get the grounding benefit also?
You know, the only one I've come across is one that I'm quite proud of. It's in my own local backyard here of Corvallis, Oregon, is a shoe company called Soft Star Shoes. And they do offer a natural leather sole.
Wow. How would you spell that?
S-O-F. Mm-hmm. I think it's Soft Star. Maybe it's Soft Star. It's either S-O-F-S-T-A-R or S-O-F-T-S-T-A-R.
And it's in Oregon?
Yeah, it's in a little town called Corvallis.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to look that up because I'd love to find something like that. I've been looking because, see, I could find a, you know, a more minimalist or more barefoot style shoe, but then it's still a rubber sole. So the whole time I'm, you know, fixing my, say, shortened calf muscle issue, I'm still not grounding myself. So I'm hoping to, you know, kill two birds with one stone with one pair of shoes. So
For sure.
Yeah, I'll definitely put a link up for people. Now, you mentioned knee pain earlier. Are you saying that a lot of the older people that are getting all of these knee replacements and crazy knee problems, this could all probably maybe not be completely avoided, but definitely a huge reduction in the amount of surgeries if they would just fix their shoes and their feet?
Yeah, no question about that. In fact, recent literature has as much as said just that, Evan. I would encourage any of our audience to look into the work of Dr. Casey Kerrigan, K-E-R-R-I-G-A-N. And she's a member of the Natural Running Center, which is a group that I belong to. I'd also like to put a shout out to our audience members for looking into the Natural Running Center. But essentially what Dr. Kerrigan has looked at and shown is that many of the high-heeled models of footwear, especially for women, puts undue stress on the part of the knee joint that's notorious for breaking down. Another group of researchers from Rush Medical Center published in Arthritis and Rheumatism that as soon as you start taking the foot away from the ground and start elevating the heel and start making the sole construction stiff, you grossly overload the knee joint by sometimes as much as 30%. So, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, but I'm not the guy that really is saying it. There's been plenty of other folks before me, and it's just a matter of, I think, getting a consensus or getting enough people to start recognizing these things, and hopefully we can avoid some of the replacements that everybody seems to be needing to get.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it probably goes back to money too, and I think there's got to be, I don't know. I hate to be too conspiratorial about it, but I think there's probably some level of suppression of this information just because it's so profitable to bring somebody in and do a knee surgery. My grandma's sister, she got a knee surgery, and you know, she's better now. She was completely miserable, so it's not that the things don't work, but you know, I definitely prefer the whole preventative approach to things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so
yeah, there's definitely that.
Go ahead.
There's definitely that money component, and there's also the component of that's just the way the training has been done, and it's kind of, medicine's an interesting profession with a certain hierarchy, and you basically end up performing what you were trained to do, and there's a certain standard of care. So there's that as well, but definitely I think the monetary issue is huge.
Yeah, you know what's funny to me, which I don't know if you've thought about this same concept, that the whole medical industry, it's called practice.
Yeah. I joke with my patients frequently about that.
Oh, man. That's great. Yeah, so your staff sent me a pair of these correct toes, and I wanted to be sure we get into these things. I've only worn them. I'm going to admit to you, I've only worn them twice for about 10 or 15 minutes each, so I haven't seen anything too dramatic yet, but please fill our audience in on how you invented these things and what they actually do for people.
Yeah. Back in, I guess it was around the same time as I started learning some of this new information from Dr. Rafi, as I mentioned, I had my second toes on both of my feet were sitting up on top of my big toe. And so as I watched these different operations being performed, I sort of had a gut reaction that I wasn't sure I wanted to have that done in my own body. And that's not to say surgery can't be indicated at times, and that's not to say that there aren't some great surgeons out there. But I really got to questioning whether or not it was going to be necessary to cut the tendons and the muscles and so forth, and, or whether or not I could apply some of the principles that Dr. Rossi taught about and actually slowly rehab my foot back to natural. So I happened to be hanging out with a physical therapist one evening in a nursing home, and I happened to notice this one lady had gotten contracted in her bed from just sitting in one position too long. And I noticed that after he warmed her up for an appropriate amount of time, he was able to get her range of motion back. And that kind of got my brain thinking about, well, what if I just started putting single silicone splints in between my big toe and second toe? And at that time, I recognized that my shoes were way too small. I was wearing a size 9, and now I wear a 12. So over the course of several years, I was just buying these little drugstore silicone separators and putting them between my big toe and second toe, between my fourth toe and fifth toe. And not only was my knee feeling better, my back was feeling better, and my wife kept saying, your feet are changing. And so I decided to start talking to my patient population about this idea that maybe I don't have to take them to the hospital and maybe they don't need a bunionectomy or a hammer toe correction. And long and short of it is we sort of got tired of having to put four single silicone splints in between each of our toes. And so I got together with a designer and I said, I have this idea. Can you build something that goes in between all of the toes and makes the human foot wider at the ends of the toes than at the ball of the foot? And the designer said, sure, no problem. He went back to his lab and he made a prototype. And that was about probably year 2000 or so. And we've just been working away at it ever since. What it essentially does, Evan, is it gives you back that natural foot shape that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, at birth, the widest part of the foot is at the end of the toes. And a cool thing for our audience to hear about is if any one of us were to get on an airplane today and, say, go to Africa or some parts of Asia or South America, we would see adults, members of those cultures and those societies, whose feet still look like they did at birth.
Right.
And so the take-home message for adult Americans who want to think preventively and want to avoid some of the more aggressive footwork would be to think about reapproximating that natural human foot shape in their own body. And so that's what really Correct Toes is all about. It's a medical-grade silicone appliance that tries to gently, slowly over, you know, months to years, tries to get that foot back the way nature intended.
Wow. Yeah, I was working with your staff about getting a link up, so I don't have the URL yet, but of course this is a pre-recorded show, so I'll add it in later, but I'm definitely interested in getting my audience to check these things out because I have them and I'm going to keep using them, and I really do I know there's got to be something to this. My second toe's not quite over my big toe, but you know, it's pretty close. I mean, if you just kind of let it sit there, it'll kind of, you know, sit above it naturally, I guess.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting.
Well, let's get you on the prevention path too.
Yeah, so see, I've always looked at my feet, and maybe I can send you a picture of my feet or something. You can send me your professional analysis or something, but on my right here, so I'm looking at my right foot, and it's relatively skinny, and then all of a sudden it just juts out. And I would say, so let's say maybe 1, 2, 3, maybe 3.5 to 4 inches from the bottom or the back of my pinky toe. That's how long that thing is, and it's on the far right side of my foot. You're saying maybe that's how it's supposed to be. Maybe my feet are normal.
Yeah, I bet they are. In fact, in our clinic, one of the things that we do when people come in to get fitted and get evaluated is we take a picture of their feet. And it's surprising as we're taking pictures of these people's feet, how many of them make some sort of a negative comment about their feet.
Yeah.
They're too high arch, they're too flat, they're too wide, they're too this, they're too that. And if you had been a fly on the wall in our clinic, you'd realize that almost everybody says something like that.
Yeah.
And so what I'm careful to tell them as we share with them that about 90% of the people that we see can't really fit into footwear if they want to have their foot naturally positioned, we go out of our way to let them know that it's not their foot that is the problem. It's a footwear industry that seems to think that the only options available need to be foot-deforming options. And I really believe that's the essence of it. I think most people can have healthy feet throughout their lives if they can understand this information and go about the tough search of finding footwear that will let this happen. That's the other hard piece about this is, you know, not only, you know, putting a silicone product on your foot to spread your toes, but then being able to go out into the retail marketplace and discuss with somebody about how to fit this natural foot.
Right.
It's still a fairly foreign concept to most people.
Yeah, you know, I'm really grateful to be able to talk with you, though, because this is timeless information. You know, that's always my goal with this show is just to try to provide information that will never age. And, you know, I'm sure maybe there'll be some more evolution, you know, as this more natural foot movement catches on and picks up speed. But I really think that you figured out enough now to keep people from a lot of really pretty miserable problems. I mean, I couldn't think of anything worse, really, than not being able to walk on your feet due to bunions and issues that are so painful.
Oh, it is terrible. It's surprising how many people get affected by this, and that's another reason why I get quite passionate about this. When I finished podiatry school, I belonged to a group called the APMA, the American Podiatric Medical Association. And at that time, the statistic that they were sharing with the public was that about 70% of adult Americans are going to develop a foot problem at some point in their lifetime. And that statistic has since gone up in the last 15 years to being 87%. So, you know, when you look at that kind of a number, you really have to ask yourself, what's wrong with the bigger picture? If that many people are going to have a failure in that body part, what are we missing? And I'm convinced that we're missing what Dr. Rossi spent his entire life trying to get people to see. And it sounds like he was up against the same sorts of influences in his day as we are today. Money was a big one. He talked a lot about people needing to describe things that the footwear was doing that were favorable. And if you don't have a background in biomechanics or natural anatomy, you wouldn't know. You would put your faith in the person selling you the shoe. And too often that exact same mentality persists today.
You know, that's a really good point you mentioned, because I've actually done some research and figured out that, you know, Pepsi and some of the big industries of Coca-Cola and any marketing industry, really, they hire neuroscientists and psychologists to figure out how the brain works, to figure out how deceptive they can make things for people to actually buy them, you know, even if they know they're not good for them, just because the marketing's so good. And I was curious, do you think that these shoe companies, do they have, you know, doctors like you that are employed that just don't know what they're talking about, or do they just simply have no clue? They're just, you know, designers on a computer program designing a shoe that just looks cool.
I think there's both. I definitely know that plenty of the shoe companies that I'm familiar with have hired physicians and podiatrists and biomechanists and so forth. But I also have come up against something that's quite interesting. I actually am friends with a lot of the designers here at my local company, Nike. And although some of them might be open to these ideas, it seems as if they're still reporting to some higher authority who I don't get the opportunity to meet, who seems to think that we need to keep everything status quo. I hear interesting things like target audiences for some of these footwear companies isn't the adult American trying to hike, you know, the Grand Canyon. It's 12 to 16-year-old adolescents worldwide who are purely looking for a cool-looking shoe or purely looking for some kind of brand loyalty.
Wow. So, yeah,
and then I think what you said is also true. I think there's a lot of people that really don't have a background in foot science and are sitting at a computer trying to come up with the next greatest marketable thing.
Yeah, you know, the brand Jordan, you know, Michael Jordan shoe line.
Yeah.
I mean,
Oh, yeah.
People they'll camp out in a sleeping bag outside a Foot Locker waiting for those things to launch, and they'll pay $130 or $150 and you know, I've seen some that are $200, and
Yeah. That's
just crazy that, you know, the marketing over, it literally kind of like overrides people's brain for rationality about what the shoe's actually going to do. But I guess, like you said, if it's marketed as cool and did you ever have those little pump it up shoes where you squeeze the tongue and pump them up?
No, but I've seen those.
Yeah, I mean, they were more popular when I was a little kid, but everybody bought them back then. You'd pump your tongue, and then I don't know what they had. I guess they had some kind of airbag or something in the sole of your shoe. I mean, it was completely ridiculous, but...
One of the things that Dr. Rossi talked about, too, was his desire that people that take care of feet would understand shoes a bit better, and that people that build shoes would understand feet a bit better. And I think we're still largely in the same place as when he was alive. I don't think there's enough communication going on between those two groups of folks.
Yeah. Yep. I would say you're right. Definitely. Yes. I mean, it looks like you're going to pay a little bit more to get a shoe that's actually designed for you, but hopefully with anything, as the more people catch on, the more people buy it, maybe that would give opportunity for the price to go down. Do you think that's a possibility?
I do. I definitely do. In fact, I think I've seen that within the Ultra brand. When they first came out, they had to keep their adult offerings, you know, commensurate with retail marketplace. But they've launched a kids line recently, and I was pleasantly surprised to hear the price point was $45.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, there's so many kids shoes out there that are too expensive.
Yeah, you could definitely spend you know, a week's worth of groceries on a pair of shoes. But I guess, you know, play devil's advocate, you could just say, well, that's more important, really, you know, your footwear. If you spend $100 one time or $150 one time, those should last you for a while. And most of us are on our feet so much that you just have to suck it up and make the investment and, you know, take control of your health. I guess that's kind of the overwhelming takeaway from everything we've talked about, is just that you have to prioritize these things. Otherwise, the long-term life of your feet and ultimately your health will be a lot worse if you don't think about it now. So what do you think people should do right now? If you know, like you do have the opportunity right now to tell people, what should they be doing? Where should they go with their life? And before I let you answer that, tell me how in the world you manage a practice and you have a beautiful wife and two children and you manage to create correct toes and do all of these things and still have time to run and all that. That's an accomplishment in itself.
Well, thank you, Evan. I'm really, really blessed to have a super team that I work with who really expertly help take care of me and manage my time. I also have my wife is not only beautiful, as you mentioned, and I thank you for that. She's also a skilled manager and can accomplish things within the clinic setting that I cannot. I'm not a businessman by any means, and so she holds down the fort there. But it's something I love to do, and having seen the potential benefit for people, I'm so eager to spend my time, you know, just reaching a few people. I'd like to reach large audiences, like I'm sure you would too. You know, a lot of my friends keep telling me, you know, as long as you can just make life better for a few people, that's good enough. So I just really enjoy helping people achieve their goals, whether it be you know, just to be out of pain, or whether they have some kind of activity and goal in mind as well.
Yeah. Well, I guarantee some people will reach out to you after this show, because I got a pretty passionate audience that seems to love any other passionate person, and you're definitely right about that. Just loving what you do, it just enables me to keep doing this. I mean, this is so fun for me to get to talk with you. I wouldn't have had this opportunity if I just would have randomly called up your place and said, oh, hey, can I talk to Dr. Ray for an hour and talk to him about feet? I probably would have been shut down, but, you know, since I have a podcast, that's my little secret to get in touch with cool people. So I really appreciate you coming on to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Adam. It's been great spending time with you.
Awesome. Well, yeah, so where should we send people? If they're in the Portland area, they can come see you locally, but do you also do any type of, like, long-distance coaching or talking with people, or how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, we actually do Skype consults and emails. Those are available through Dr. Potter and Dr. Herman, my associate doctors. And you can either contact the clinic via the website, which is nwfootankle.com, or you can certainly look us up in the phone book and get a hold of us that way.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah, I don't know how many people have phone books, but...
I'm dating myself.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, awesome. So we'll send people back to that website for sure, NW Foot Ankle. And there's a lot of information, even if they don't get in contact with you, there's a lot of information here that's really interesting about corns and calluses and crooked toes and all of these things. Oh, I didn't even ask you. So the correct toes, they can also fix crooked toes?
Definitely, yeah. The other nice thing about them is oftentimes when you get a bunion, you'll also have a second toe that sits up on top like we talked about. So the nice effect of the correct toes is it pushes the big toe out of the way and gives the second toe an opportunity to get back down in its natural space. And as you've seen, the product has a little bit of silicone strip on the top that will take a crooked toe like that and reorient it back into its natural alignment.
Wow, very cool. And so how often should I put these things on, and how long should I wear them?
Yeah, if you've had two episodes of roughly 15 minutes, you should probably have your next episode somewhere between 25 and 30 minutes, and then add somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes per day until you can comfortably wear them a full day. Most of us wear them all day, every day. I wear them to work. I run in them. I hike in them. But you definitely want to kind of go slow. There's a break-in process outlined in the handout that comes with the product. Mm-hmm. And so you want to be careful about not doing too much too soon. And I think for our audience and anybody else who is interested in correct toes, the other key feature is that you want to make sure that you have footwear that works with it. A lot of folks will buy the product and not read the pamphlet, but just put it on their foot and go in their shoe that they're typically in. And that can actually create a lot of problems because of what we talked about today. Most footwear isn't going to let you have your natural foot shape. So that's another thing that our audience would have to be really aware of.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I wasn't aware you actually wear them in the shoes all day. That's interesting. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
If there's anything else you want to leave people with, please tell us.
Yeah, I would say what we touched on a moment ago, Evan, would be one of the primary focuses I want folks to think about, and that's prevention. If you can prevent foot problems earlier on in life, it's so much more gratifying than, you know, doing disaster management when there's no other option. But I think if there were one overarching theme for the whole conversation, what I wish for people to think about is I want people to think about whether or not their shoe is shaped like a natural foot. Mm-hmm. I think if we can get people thinking about that on their own terms, I think then we might see more people becoming aware of what really needs to happen for true foot health to occur.
Yes, definitely agree. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate you coming on. This is great, and I'll be in touch with you again soon. I'd love to have you back on and dig deeper into these other foot disorders and issues, because, I mean, it's deeper than what we got into today, definitely.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that, Evan.
Awesome. Okay, well, take care, and I will let you know when this episode is up.
Sounds great. You take care too, Evan.
All right, thank you. Bye. All right, once again, that was Dr. Ray. That was a really fun episode for me, so I love branching out on other topics about the human experience, so I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Now, like I mentioned at the beginning, if you all want to support me, go to notjustpaleo.com and look in the menu bar, and you'll see books, and you click right there, and you'll see Rim Rehab, and you can pick up the audio book, you could pick up the ebook, you could pick up the whole package, but it's really my best work that I've done yet, so I really appreciate all of you, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.
He acts like it's all good, yeah, like everything's cool. Kiss her girl good night and then he leaves her. She doesn't have a clue that he's terrible news. Why I'm in the tire, got to watch out, girl. Don't wanna see her cry her eyes out, girl. Cause I've been watching, you've been hurting. Let me be the one that loves you better. Yeah, so many guys I've been trying to impress you, but they can love you, girl, like I do. So if you want me, you got me, girl, as long as this is love. And from then on, girl, I will never leave ya. Travel across the world, yeah, baby, just to see ya. No matter where, girl, it don't matter where. So baby, just come in, open up your heart, I'll make love to you. There won't be no stopping, I'm gonna beat it up as long as you want me to. And baby, if you want me, you got me, girl, as long as this is love. You got me, baby. Ooh, as long as this is love. You got me, baby.
Something I need more than me is you. Something that I said I never do. Feels like I'm falling. Something tells me you feel it too. Watch my whole life, and there ain't no likeness to what I'm feeling for you. I hear you calling, I'm not walking away. I feel you coming, and the words that you say, like fast a rhythm, I take more than my share. Just let take you down, cause I'll make you
come in and open up your heart. When I'll make love to you, there won't be no stopping. I'm gonna beat it up as long as you want me to. And baby, if you want me, you got me, girl, as long as this is love. You got me, baby.
Ooh, as long as this is love.
You got me, baby. You got me, baby.
Ooh, as long as this is love.
You got me, baby. Higher than the moon in the sky. You got me feeling butterflies when I look in your eyes. Cause you know that I want you to, girl. I'm loving everything you do. You're touching me, rubbing me, kissing me, hugging me, squeezing me. Please, baby, believe I'ma be the one that loves you better. Yeah, yeah. Cause you know with me, girl, I will never leave ya. Drive across the world, yeah, baby, just to see ya. No matter where, girl, it don't matter where, oh.
So baby, just come in, open up your heart, I'll make love to you. There won't be no stopping, I'm gonna beat it up as long as you want me to.
And baby, if you want me, you got me, girl, as long as this is love. You got me, baby.
Ooh, as long as this is love.
You got me, baby. You got me, baby. You got me, baby, baby, baby.